Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 17th, 2009. I'm Stuart Wills, sitting in for our usual host, Robert Frederick. This week, the epidemiology of a major worldwide killer, an unusual weapon in the evolutionary arms race between bats and their prey, and a look at NIH's new leader. All this plus our usual roundup of the latest stories from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Rotavirus, a leading cause of severe diarrhea in children, is more than just an inconvenience for overwrought parents. It's a worldwide killer, accounting for the deaths of over 600,000 children a year, and is the target of a major global vaccination effort. It's also a disease that, while locally endemic, can bloom into seasonal epidemics that are poorly understood. Now, Virginia Pitzer of Penn State University, along with 10 colleagues, have cast a new light on the epidemiology of this killer in a paper published this week. Pitzer talked with guest interviewer Chelsea Wald about the work and began with a description of just what rotavirus is.
Rotavirus is an infection that pretty much everyone in the population gets multiple times throughout their life. It's typically spread fecal-orally, meaning when you get any sort of particles on your hands when you go to the bathroom or change a diaper, and then those particles somehow get into your mouth. In adults, it's usually asymptomatic, but in children who've never been infected before, rotavirus can cause vomiting and diarrhea, which can be severe enough to lead to hospitalization or even lead to death. In the U.S., it causes around 60,000 hospitalizations and around 30 to 40 deaths each year. Most of these are in children under 5 years of age. But worldwide, it's estimated to cause over 500,000 deaths.
And can vaccination help?
Vaccination has been shown to help. It prevents those severe infections that you see in infants the first time they encounter the virus. So instead of getting severe infection leading to diarrhea, you might get a less severe infection that gives you some diarrhea or just is asymptomatic like you see in adults. The vaccine was just introduced into the U.S. in 2006, and so now there's an effort to sort of roll that out to a number of other countries throughout the world, and one of the places where it could be most important in terms of preventing large numbers of deaths is in the developing countries. There's some developing countries in Latin America that have introduced the vaccine, but in Africa and Southeast Asia, the vaccine is yet to be introduced.
You set out to understand how rotavirus spreads in the U.S. How did you go about that?
Well, we had data on both laboratory-confirmed rotavirus in the United States and hospitalizations due to rotavirus in the United States. And we fit a mathematical model to the data that incorporated information on the epidemiology of rotavirus. For example, there have been cohort studies that followed infants from birth to 2 years of age and tested periodically for symptomatic and asymptomatic infections. There are also a number of adult challenge studies conducted in the 70s and early 80s in which people actually volunteered to be infected with the virus, which seems kind of crazy to me. But these studies lend quite a bit of insight into the nature of immunity and how long people are infectious for.
And what did you find?
Our model was able to understand this sort of mysterious pattern of spread of epidemics in the U.S. prior to vaccination. Traditionally, epidemics have started in the Southwest in December and then gradually sort of spread towards the Northeast, where the epidemics didn't peak until March. And this pattern isn't really consistent with what you'd expect from a climate variable. Temperatures tend to be high in the Southwest, but are also high in places like Florida. Nor is it consistent with what you'd expect from spatial spread, where for infections such as flu, the epidemics tend to jump from city to city and then spread out from there into more rural areas. And one of the things that I noticed when looking for data to inform the model was that birth rates in the U.S. follow the similar pattern in that they tend to be high in the Southwest and lower in the Northeast. I wasn't really sure at all that birth rates would kind of be important in driving the overall pattern of epidemics for rotavirus. It could be that adults could spread the virus just as easily as infants could spread the virus. But in fact, what our model suggests is that that's not true, that it's really these infants who have the symptomatic infections that are the ones that are really responsible for spreading the virus.
So is this finding good news or is it bad news in the fight against rotavirus?
I think that it's good news. It essentially shows that individuals who don't receive the vaccine might receive some benefit because the people in the population who are vaccinated are less likely to spread the infection. The interesting thing about vaccination is that it's essentially comparable to cutting the birth rate of these infants who've never seen the infection before by making these infants look like more fully immunized adults. And so what our model suggests is that there is some level of indirect protection provided by the vaccine, mostly against the asymptomatic infections. But at the same time, it suggests that overall people will be infected at a higher age. And if those infections occur later in life, then this could be that it also leads to less severe disease and that it's easier to treat a 5-year-old with diarrhea than it is to treat a 1-year-old.
Do you think your findings should change public health officials' approach to fighting rotavirus in the United States and around the world?
I don't think that it will necessarily change the approach. It shows that the vaccine that has been introduced is effective and can reduce the overall burden of disease. But I think that really one of the most important questions is what impact vaccination might have on the dynamics of rotavirus epidemics in these developing countries where rotavirus is still a major cause of death among infants. In order to understand that, you'd really have to fit our model to specific data from this developing country setting. And I think that we're in line now to do that, and I think that it could predict some really interesting possible consequences of vaccination.
Can you give some examples?
When they introduced vaccination against measles, what happened in places like England and Wales is that prior to vaccination, epidemics occurred relatively predictably. Every 2 years, you would see a big epidemic. And then once they started vaccinating, you actually started to get increasingly chaotic dynamics in that epidemics would sometimes occur every 3 years, sometimes every 4 years, and you'd sometimes have a long period without any epidemic and then big epidemic. And so it became harder to predict essentially when the epidemics would be occurring. And it's possible that you could end up having similar effects happening with rotavirus, both in the U.S. when you push vaccination coverage levels really high and possibly in other parts of the world.
So what questions still remain for you?
One aspect of the dynamics of rotavirus that we've sort of overlooked to this point is that there are a number of different strains of rotavirus that may lead to different levels of immunity when you get infected with a strain. The vaccines are designed to protect mostly against the most prevalent strains within the U.S. and what consequence that might have for the introduction of new strains to the population is not well understood. So that's an avenue of future research that we'd like to pursue. Another might be to better understand the rotavirus dynamics and effect of vaccination within the U.S. Infants are getting infected later, and so they're slightly older when they're going to the hospital, as well as understanding the residual variability that's in our model that's not accounted for by birth rates, and whether it's climate or some other factor that is influencing the dynamics beyond what we understand with our model.
Virginia Pitzer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Virginia Pitzer is the lead author of a new study on the epidemiology of rotavirus. She spoke with guest interviewer Chelsea Wald. You can find Pitzer's study, along with a related perspective, in this week's Science. In one of the more anticipated and less surprising recent science policy developments, U.S. President Barack Obama last week tapped Francis Collins, the former head of the National Human Genome Research Institute, to head up the National Institutes of Health. Science news writer Jocelyn Kaiser has been covering the story for the journal and its policy blog, Science Insider. Jocelyn, I guess the community was generally pretty pleased by this choice.
Yes, they were. The person who's been chosen, Francis Collins, is very well known to the research community. He was the leader of the International Human Genome Project, the head of the Genome Institute at the National Institutes of Health, and is very well respected as a scientist and as an administrator. So, yes, people are people are happy with the choice. Many biomedical research groups have praised the selection of Dr. Collins, and so have individual scientists.
And I guess he's coming into the spot at a rather interesting time. Lots to do and lots of money to spend.
Yes, NIH right now has $10 billion to spend from the economic stimulus package passed by Congress earlier this year. And that comes on top of a $30 billion annual budget. So they've got a lot of money to spend, and they're using it for various competitions. So it is a good time, but at the same time, people are very worried about what NIH is going to do when that money runs out 2 years from now. Many more scientists are being funded than had grants before, and the question is what they will do when those grants end 2 years from now.
And I guess he's got a few controversial issues on his plate as well.
Right. One of the first things he'll be dealing with is how NIH implements these rules for research on embryonic stem cells, human embryonic stem cells. This has been an extremely controversial topic, and NIH passed new rules just about a week ago, just before Collins was nominated, and now we'll need to decide what kinds of research, what stem cell lines can be studied using federal money. Another issue he'll be dealing with is conflict of interest regulations. There's been a lot of concern in the past year about researchers who receive money from drug companies, and NIH is now rewriting its regulation for that. So that's one thing he'll be dealing with.
Well, I guess one advantage for Collins, though, is he's certainly no stranger to the limelight.
That's right. Because he has headed the Human Genome Project, which has been one of the biggest things happening in biomedical research in the past 10 or 15 years. He is very well known to the community. He's also very well known to Congress. He is very well liked in Congress, and he's also very good at communicating with the public about genomics.
Oh, there must be a few critics out there, though.
That's true. There are scientists who have not been that happy about the Human Genome Project because they felt it has diverted money from individual researchers' labs and that it spent a lot of money and resources on a big technology project that is not really what science is all about. So those people worry that Collins is going to want to do more of these sort of big biology projects, as they're called, and not fund the individual investigators. And the other concern is that people think that the Human Genome Project has yet to pay off and show benefits that are meaningful for patients, and that Collins has oversold it. So that's another criticism that he will be dealing with as director.
I guess some people have also objected to his religious views, which have stoked a bit of controversy in scientific circles.
That's right. Francis Collins grew up as, he says, an agnostic or atheist, but when he was in his 20s, he became an evangelical Christian, and I think I'm not sure he was all that public about it until a few years ago. In 2006, he wrote a book called The Language of God that describes how he reconciles his religious beliefs with the science of evolution, and many scientists have They disagree with his point of view. Many scientists think that you can't really truly be a scientist and be a Christian at the same time, that the point where those meet, you just lose the science. And another concern is that a couple months ago, he started this website called Biologos that is kind of taking off from the book and trying to explain evolution to Christians. And again, scientists say that this is not scientific. And they're also concerned that as director, he would let his Christian beliefs influence decisions he makes on topics like stem cells and perhaps sexual research, or maybe he'd want to fund a study of prayer and healing. But others point out that he hasn't done anything like this as director of the Human Genome Project, and that there's no evidence at all that he would do it as NIH director.
Jocelyn Kaiser, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jocelyn Kaiser writes about the nomination of Francis Collins as NIH director in this week's issue of Science and on the policy blog, Science Insider. A paper published in Science this week uncovers an unusual new weapon in the ongoing evolutionary struggle between predator and prey. Tiger moths have apparently evolved the ability to jam the echolocating sonar used by their bat predators to home in on the moths as dinner prospects, in much the way that an airborne target might jam the radar of a pursuing aircraft. Guest interviewer Stephanie Chastine talked with the study's lead author, Aaron Corcoran of Wake Forest University, who took a few minutes off from collecting new moths for research at a field station in Arizona to talk about the work's significance.
Well, this study involves what's called the bat-insect evolutionary arms race. So basically, the bats developed a highly sophisticated sonar for detecting, localizing, and eventually capturing the insects. Various insects developed ears to hear this sonar and do evasive maneuvers, and then bats have countered with various other attack strategies. So to take this one step further, certain tiger moths develop the ability to produce sound when bats attack them. And the aim of this study was to ask why. Why are these moths making sound? And more particularly, why is one particular species of tiger moth making a whole lot of sound? And here's what those clicks would sound like, transformed into the audible range and slowed down by a factor of 10. So we put forth various predictions and hypotheses about the bat's responses, and all of the responses of the bats matched the sonar jamming hypothesis. So as far as we're aware, this is the first behavioral documentation that moths, or any animal for that matter, can jam the sonar of bats.
What kind of thing do most moths do?
Most moths have ears, and when the bats attack them, they either head the opposite direction in order to get out of the way, and so the bat won't even be able to detect the moth, or various moths will use loops and spirals and power dives to evade the bat when it's attacking.
So what were some of the ideas of what these particular sounds that the tiger moths were making could mean?
Right. So it's been known for probably 50 years that tiger moths make sound, and there have been pretty well-established hypotheses as to what these sounds are actually doing as a defense mechanism. The first is that the sounds are a startle mechanism. Bats having the mammalian startle response could be thrown off by that. That's the first one. The second one is called the aposematism hypothesis, or the warning hypothesis. And this hypothesis involves moths that are toxic or that are pretending to be toxic. And basically, they're sending a message to the bats that they don't taste very good. And the third strategy is a jamming defense. Jamming would involve sounds that the moth are making actually disrupting the sonar system of the bat in such a way that the bat can't detect or track the moth accurately enough to catch it in the last moments of the attack.
So how does one go about figuring out which one of those hypotheses is correct, whether or not the clicks are startling or warning the bats or jamming their sonar? Did you put the bats into a little MRI machine or something?
No. So we used what's called a behavioral learning paradigm or behavioral learning experiment. And just in the past few years have been the first experiments where we actually have live bats and live moths interacting together. And the setup for this study and prior studies in our lab involves a padded room that absorbs all the echoes, and we have ultrasonic recording equipment and infrared video recording at high speed. And then we have a moth that we introduce into the environment. It's tethered to a very fine line, and then we release bats into the room and record the interactions over a series of days.
I gotta ask, how do you tether a moth?
We have a very small clip, a surgical microclip. So we basically have a very thin fishing line that's hooked up to this very small clip, and then that is used to attach to the moth's abdomen.
That sounds challenging.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time figuring out our setup for attaching a moth to a line.
So then what?
So the first step was determining whether the moth clicks were indeed causing the bats to be deterred. So a part of our setup was to present moths that were able to produce sound and then moths that we had silenced their sound producing organs. And we found that when the moths were making sound, the bats were only catching them maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 5 times. But once we silenced the moths' sound producing organs, the bats were able to catch them reliably, almost every time.
If the moths were startling the bats, you'd expect to see the bats avoid the moths at first and then get used to the sound. What did you see?
So we actually saw that the defense was effective right away, and there was no sort of habituation or no learning that was required for the defense to be effective. So that helped us rule out the startle hypothesis.
What about the sort of warning, hey, I taste bad, don't eat me?
Right. For the warning hypothesis, first of all, we would expect that with a warning sound, The bats have to learn to associate the clicks with the warning. So initially, bats would ignore the clicks, capture the moths, find them distasteful, and drop them. But we didn't see that. The defense was effective right away.
So that leaves us with hypothesis number three of jamming. How did you arrive at that conclusion that they're actually jamming the sonar?
Right. So with a jamming defense, we would expect very little or no habituation, as would be happening with startle, and no learning or association is required. So it would be effective right away. So the pattern of the bat's response over the period of the experiment matched our predictions for the sonar jamming hypothesis. Another part of kind of our documentation to show that it was jamming had to do with the bat's sonar response. So normally, as a bat is attacking an insect, it will go through a series of stages where the bat is increasing the repetition rate until finally it's going so fast that it goes into what sounds like a buzz. Now, what we observed in our study is that when the bats heard the moth's clicks, this normal sequence was disrupted, and the bats started slowing down their repetition rate when normally they would be speeding it up. So that would sound like this. So this indicated that the bat was rather confused, but that it was still trying to capture the moth, but having a really hard time doing so.
And this is research, of course, on a very specific species of moth and of bat. Does this affect our thinking about the coevolution of insects and bats in general?
Well, it represents kind of a new level of escalation and a new level of sophistication on the part of the moths. It could be argued that this is one of the most sophisticated acoustic defenses that any animal has developed. This is a much deeper and much more intricate arms race than we've realized in the past. And there are likely other turns, other twists to the story that haven't been documented thus far. And those are some of the things that we're going to be trying to figure out in the future.
Well, Aaron Corcoran, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Aaron Corcoran spoke with guest interviewer Stephanie Chastine about the new paper, Tiger Moths Jam Bat Sonar. You can read the paper in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. First, Dave, kind of an interesting result on the psychological risks of genetic screening.
Right. Well, this is kind of a good news, bad news story, Stuart. And the bad news is, imagine sitting in a doctor's office and that doctor tells you, you have a genetic predisposition for Alzheimer's disease. Obviously, that's not the kind of news you want to hear. But this new study offers a little bit of a silver lining here. What it says is that even if you get really bad news like this, chances are it's not going to make you depressed or anxious, at least in the short term.
And how did they figure that out?
Well, what they did was, this study came about because of concerns about genetic testing. You know, as researchers continue to isolate disease genes, whether it be for Alzheimer's or breast cancer, there's a bunch of companies that are starting to crop up that say, hey, send us some of your saliva in the mail, and we'll tell you whether you've got a predisposition for these diseases. But bioethicists are worried about this because they said, you know, is it a good idea for people to find out this information? Yes, it could be helpful clinically, but it could contribute to depression and other similar disorders. And so they worry, you know, is getting this information out there such a good thing? And that's what this study is all about. And for this study, researchers focused on Alzheimer's disease. And the reason they focus on Alzheimer's is because it's a disease right now that doesn't have a cure. So they figure that people getting this information about being predisposed to Alzheimer's...
If you were going to be depressed about anything, you'd be depressed about this.
Exactly. And so they took a group of people that had relatives with Alzheimer's, and they ran a genetic test on them, which tests for the presence of a variant in a gene known as APOE. And this variant is called E4. And people that have one copy of E4 are about three times more likely than people in the general population to develop Alzheimer's. people with two copies are 15 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's. And what they did was they genetically tested these people, and then they divided them into three groups. And with a third of the people, they didn't tell them anything about the results from their genetic test. They just completely kept them in the dark. And a third of the people that had good news, and in other words, they didn't have this E4 variant, they told them, hey, good news, you're not at any greater risk for Alzheimer's. And a third of the people that did have the E4 variants, they said, hey, bad news, you're at an increased risk for Alzheimer's.
And then they, I guess, looked at the psychological effect that this had.
Exactly. And what they did was over the next year, they conducted these tests, these psychological tests, where they tested the people's anxiety levels, their depression levels, their levels of distress. First of all, the not surprising result was that people that got the good news tended to be happier, or at least less depressed than the other two groups. But what was surprising is that there was really no difference between the people that were completely kept in the dark versus the people that were told bad news. They were basically both at the same baseline level of depression and anxiety. So in other words, getting this bad news doesn't seem to cause people to be any more depressed or anxious than not getting any news at all. And one other interesting finding was that the researchers found that even the people that got the bad news, 98% of them said that they think these genetic tests are a good idea and they'd be willing to take such tests again. So it just goes to show that people would rather have this information than not have it, and that having it doesn't actually seem to confer any bad consequences, at least emotionally.
Well, as you say, kind of a good news, bad news story. Turning to something sort of completely different, David, the other day I was, while I was at home getting ready for work, I bumped my head into a door jamb and I said actually a very naughty word.
Something we couldn't say on the podcast.
Exactly. Something not suitable for a family podcast. I guess just why I might have reacted that way is the subject of your next story.
That's right. This is about whether cursing actually makes us feel better. And surprisingly, there really haven't been any studies on this. It's sort of anecdotal. You know, when we curse and when we do something painful, whether it's you hitting your head on a door jamb or a woman, say, cursing while she's giving birth, there tends to be a lot of swearing going on during these circumstances. And it maybe goes to reason that there's a reason we're swearing. So a scientist said, well, let's test this idea. And what he did was he recruited a bunch of undergraduates from the school that he does his research at, and he had them jot down words on two lists. One list was, you know, write down some words you might say if you, say, hit your fingers with a hammer. And I can't say what these words were, but if you look at the story, some of the words are reprinted there, or at least almost fully reprinted there. And on the other list, he said, just give me some words you'd use to describe a table. So very neutral words like brown or square or wooden. And then what he did was he had these undergraduates hold their hands in a bucket of ice water.
Well, that doesn't sound very pleasant.
It's not. And this is actually a common test for pain tolerance. And what these students were supposed to do is, while they had their hand in the water, they were either supposed to repeat a word from their swear list or a word from their table list.
Or go, brown, brown.
Exactly. And what this researcher found is, when these students were swearing, they were actually able to hold their hands in the water, in the ice water, for a lot longer. And there was actually even a gender difference. Men, on average, were able to hold their hands in the water about 30% longer when swearing, versus women that were able to hold their hands for about 44% longer in the water while swearing.
And why on earth would that be?
Well, they don't really have an explanation, although they say that men tend to swear more than women do. So when women swear, it's rarer, and therefore it may be more effective.
Well, just in the larger sense, why would this actually work? I mean, I think a lot of us probably have, you know, who have this particular vice, have an intuitive sense that swearing might make you feel a little better. But what does that really mean?
Well, that's the next step for the researchers. There's a couple of theories. This researcher says he thinks it might have something to do with aggression. Swearing may amp up aggression, and aggression has been shown in some studies to decrease pain. And another expert says that there's circuits in our brain that are able to regulate pain, and perhaps swearing somehow activates or decreases the activity in these circuits. So it's still an open question.
And finally, we switch to a different kind of utterance, the purring of cats, which is a bit more complicated, I guess, than we all thought.
Indeed it is. And Stuart, this last study is all thanks to a cat named Peepo. And Peepo is a cat that lives in the UK, and Peepo has a very bad habit of waking her owner up in the middle of the night to request food. But Peepo doesn't wake her owner up by screaming or meowing very loudly. Peepo wakes her owner up by purring.
Well, that doesn't sound like the best strategy for waking someone up.
Well, it turns out that the way Peepo purrs is different from the way she normally purrs when she's happy. When Peepo wakes her owner up in the middle of the night, her purr has an extra element in it. It's got this higher frequency element that makes the purr sound more urgent. And at first, the researcher sort of brushed this off and said, well, maybe this is just something unique to Peepo. But it turns out she started talking to a bunch of her friends, and her friends also reported similar stories with their cats, that the purrs that these cats were using to wake them up at night sounded different from the cat's normal purrs. So this researcher said, well, I'm a scientist. I got to figure out if there's something behind this. So what she did was she had a bunch of these owners record their cat's purrs, record their cat's purrs when the cats were happy, and record these middle of the night or food requesting purrs. And she analyzed them, and indeed she found that there was a difference. There was a high-pitched meow hidden in these what are called solicitous purrs. And see if you can hear the difference here. Here's a normal purr. And here's a solicitous purr.
Definitely higher frequency on the second one.
Definitely. And what the researcher found is that when she played these purrs to people to a bunch of random people, some people who owned cats and some people that didn't own cats, about 75% of the people could tell, not only tell the difference, but felt that this solicitous purr was a lot more urgent. It felt like the cat was really wanted something.
So almost like a baby's cry.
Exactly. And that's what the researcher says. She says this high frequency element in the purr may remind humans of the cry of infants. And so cats have sort of learned to incorporate this into their purr as a way of getting attention.
As a way of training us.
Exactly.
Well, sounds like a nice little result. So what other stories is the Science News team looking at this week?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we're looking at stories about how hunting has impacted social structure in African elephants, and also about a lizard that swims through sand. And on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into a story about internet addiction in China, and we're also continuing our coverage on the UC system. This is the University of California system, which has been hit really hard by budget cuts and how researchers there are coping. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the Science Podcast for July 17th, 2009. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.